So let's just review for a minute where we went last class. Things to get right at the beginning. There's a phrase that actually occurs in Ortberg's book where he, at the beginning of chapter 2, he quotes Dallas Willard. And Dallas Willard's, to paraphrase, says this: spirituality and Christian spirituality wrongly understood is a great source of human misery. Isn't that striking? Christian spirituality wrongly understood is a great source of human misery. So as much as we can, by God's grace, we want to get certain principles down very clearly at the beginning of the class, because I don't want you feeling miserable. Jesus says things that are very hard, very difficult to embrace, but he does not desire for us to be miserable, deeply unhappy, unfulfilled, angry, bitter, sad, and so on, though he'll say very hard things. So, by way of reminder, let's review a few things. The call to discipleship is the call to change. And that's why it's hard. That's why it's hard. Change is inherently difficult. It's not easy to change, is it? It's not easy to change. But Bonhoeffer encourages us. The call to discipleship is the call to change, first thing. Second thing, this is all about love. To be formed, the sign of being formed into the image of Christ deeply is that love appears in a human being's life. Love for neighbors, love for friends, by God's grace, it's all about grace, love for enemies, love. Spiritual growth is not about rule keeping. It's not about legalism. It's not about moral rigorism. It's not about all that nastiness that sooner or later we all encounter when we come to issues of spiritual formation and become discouraged by. People who are, how to put this, people who are moving deeply into Jesus Christ are very attractive in the sense of you want to be with them. I think they tend to be rather earthy. I think they have probably a good sense of humor. They're relaxed, not deeply concerned about themselves in terms of the impression they're trying to make on anybody. They're filled with love. They're safe to be around. Kind of people you want to hang out with, because love is appearing in their life. So Christ wants us. He desires us. He wants to blossom within us. And so at times, he'll say things that are hard. He'll say things that are hard to catch our attention. He'll say things that are hard to crack us open like a nut so that his light begins to flow into us. And all the carbon, all that spiritual carbon, all that stuff begins slowly but surely to burn away through the light of the Holy Spirit. But it stings. And at times you just want to cry. At times you want to say, Lord, this is too much you're asking. This is too much. And he says, trust me. In fact, you might start off today's time together. Just write that word in block letters in your notes, trust. Because he'll ask us to trust. There's a certain kind of prayer. It's called the prayer of relinquishment. Prayer of relinquishment, we will actually say to Christ something like this. This is real trust, I would think. Kill me this day if you must, but I desire everything you have for me. Well, that's a prayer of relinquishment. It's like diving off a diving board backwards. Remember that Nestle commercial? I'm probably aging myself. There was a Nestle commercial once a long time ago. And in that Nestle commercial, you have someone standing on a diving board, and they launch themselves backwards. And as they're falling backwards, you hear, oh, Nestle. Well, diving into Christ is something like that. It's trusting he's going to catch us. It's trusting that he knows what to do with us. After all, he is God incarnate. So think about some of these texts that we were talking about last class. I want to review it just briefly because they will show up on the quiz, and also because I think they're very important. So the first text has to do with this situation with the rich young man in Mark chapter 10, starting with, what was it, verse 17, something like that. And here you have a young man who desires to be in relationship with Christ. He desires to please Christ. And Christ asks him that very direct question. Do you remember? Why do you call me good? Why do you call me good? He is apt to do that kind of thing with us. He's apt to ask questions. So here's an interesting journal exercise you might try and emphasize. It has to do with questions. Imagine I'm teaching here today, and the back door of the auditorium opens, and in walks Jesus Christ. How would we feel? If we really knew it was Christ. Oh my goodness gracious. How would you feel? I'd feel excited, and I'd feel intimidated, and I'd be thinking about the last week. What have I been up to? I've been thinking all kinds of things. And he comes down to one of us and sits down beside us and that person and says, we are going to spend the afternoon together. We're going to spend the afternoon together. And I'm going to ask you three questions. Now, here's the journaling exercise. If Christ walked up to you and said, we're going to spend the afternoon together, and he said, I'm going to ask you three questions. What do you think they'd be? What do you think he'd ask? About 15, 20 years ago, I know one of the questions he would have asked me. Chris, why are you so afraid? Why are you so afraid? And I would have said, well, the world's a dangerous place. A lot of people get killed. People get sick. Families fall apart. Mine dead. And he can absorb our response. What do you think he'd ask you? What do you think he'd ask you? And it's only fair. This is the second half of the journaling exercise, if you choose to do it. Here's the second half. After he asks you those three questions and you respond as well as you can, he says, all right, what are the three questions you'd like to ask me? What do you think they'd be? If Jesus Christ was having a cup of coffee with you and he said, feel free to ask. Feel free to ask. I always thought for a long time, much less so today, but 30 years ago, I thought, all right, I'm going to ask. Why did my parents get divorced? I prayed so hard. So what would you ask him? You might ask him, how can you be present as a human being, fully human just as I am apart from sin, and omnipresent throughout the entire universe? Well, that's a big one. Or you might ask a question that's smaller and more related to your own personal life. So try that one on for size. So we have a young man. He runs up to Jesus, wants to follow Christ, and Christ in great love wounds him. Do you remember that? The young man walked away grieved. You could journal about this. When was the last time that you felt wounded by God? Wounded by God. Grieved by God. And you didn't understand why. Think of this rich young man. He seems to be trying his level best to please Christ. And Christ, at least as far as this text goes, Christ allows him to walk away. And in one version of that text, the text says, he walked away deeply grieved. And in some way, Mark chapter 10 is love in action. It's a tough text, is it not? And then we have Luke chapter 14. Now remember what Luke chapter 14 is about. It's all about this messianic banquet. Do you remember? It's about an upside down kingdom. It's about values being inverted from the perspective of the religious leaders of Israel. The wrong people are being invited to the banquet. Crippled, blind people, lame people. We thought they were under God's judgment. Surely, Rabbi, we're invited. Some says, so Jesus says, well, you're invited too, as long as you become like them and admit your own blindness. It's a tough text. This reversal, it's an upside-down kingdom, full of surprises, full of surprises. When was the last time you could journal about this? When was the last time God surprised you? Sometimes he surprises us. We think, oh, that was just great. There's just nothing better than that kind of surprise. I'll open that kind of surprise any day I want, any day. And then there's other surprises, and we weep. And we think, Lord, you could not possibly ask me to accept this. Please, take it back. Now, and then, of course, that third text we look at was what, from Matthew 7, about a wide gate and narrow gate and a broad way leading to destruction and a narrow way that leads to life. One would have thought it would be just the reverse, that things should be easier rather than harder if you come into relationship with God. And what I guess the rhythm would be something like this. At times, they really are wondrous, and the path is smooth, and we let out a hoot. And at other times, it feels like we've got chains around our feet, and we wonder where he is. Why aren't you responding? I've been praying. And it's like our prayers bounce off of heaven. He's very mysterious. So it's very important, as we think about this call to change, it's really important to know what God is like and what God is not like. Do you remember that from last class? Those dysfunctional views of God? What was the first one? God is a distant, demanding parent, kind of a Norman Bates God. A distant, demanding parent, whining, never satisfied, always reminding us of how much we've been given, and why aren't you doing better? And then we had that second dysfunctional view of God. God is this harsh taskmaster, like a spiritual drill instructor. God is someone who yells a lot. Why aren't you doing better? Wake up! Yeah, you in the back row, wake up! That kind of thing. God's not like that. But sometimes we think he is. And then that very serious, distorted view of God as a cosmic monster of some kind who allows these things to take place in the world, and we shake our heads and we wonder, what in the world is going on? And then for some of us, God is this distant, or not distant, demanding figure, but rather that, self-indulgent grandfather, smiling, happy with us, regardless of what we do. Would love look like that? Someone who would be happy with us regardless of what we're doing. If you saw if you had a child and you saw your child walking down a railroad track, would you be gentle at that point if you saw a train coming? I think not. So love acts in lots of different ways. So in replacing these dysfunctional, distorted views of God, it's very important for us to think through what God is like, because then we can trust God. We know what God is like. We can trust God even in the midst of the perplexities of life. But it's very important to get this right from the beginning. And Christ invites us to do so. So, for example, you have your Bible. Turn to John. This is the Gospel of John, John 14, verse 1. Don't let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. There's that word. Trust in God, trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I'm going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I'll come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I'm going. Now, we read that text, and many of us are familiar with this text and find it somewhat comforting. The disciples did not. And the reason they did not was the idea of a Messiah who's leaving did not make sense to them theologically. We'll talk about that in some detail next week. It did not make sense. They did not want him to leave. They wanted him to stay. They wanted him to reign over Jerusalem and Israel and reign over the world, as Isaiah had promised. So Thomas speaks up.
Verse 5. Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way?
I like Thomas. It's a good question. You're not being helpful, Lord. This is not helpful. You're asking me to trust you, and you're leaving.
I'll trust you, but you got to stay.
Let me help here. Messiahs don't leave. Messiahs stay. Messiahs reign.
Jesus answered. Here's this text we all know. I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Now look at verse 7 and underline it. If you really knew me, if you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him and what? See in the text? Have seen him. Have seen him. Now, Philip, who sometimes tends to be a little bit out of his depth, but at least he asks questions, says, Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough for us. And at this point, I think Jesus sat down and just caught his breath. Did you see the next line in the text? I can just see him. All right. They're not getting it. Because he's just on the edge of impatience here with Philip. He says, don't you know me, Philip? Even after I have been with you such a long time, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Don't you believe that I'm in the Father and that the Father is in me? The words that I speak are not just my own. So what's God like? Well, we can make this a fundamental building block, fundamental beginning point. God is like Jesus Christ. Christ himself invites us to look at him and to ask questions and to be involved in a very, what I would think would be lively relationship of deep honesty and openness and all kinds of things. But he says, you want to know what God is like? It's a good question. Look at me. Look at me. And then what he does is he, turn over Luke 15. He knows that's tough because life is not easy. And we sin, for instance. We sin and we got all this stuff. And if we're going to trust God to deal with all this stuff and somehow rinse it out of our system, we have to be able to trust him and know that if we open ourselves up to him, if we open ourselves up to the possibility of change, he's not going to turn into Norman Bates' mother and start screaming. Rinsing that stuff out is one of the first steps towards change. So can we trust him? He says, if you want to know what God is like, look at me. In Luke 15, he gives three examples of people who are struggling in some way and are in relationship with God. And in that relationship with God, as they're struggling with stuff, Jesus uses specific examples. Now, there is a real danger that we're anesthetized from these texts. So what I'm going to do with one of them is I'm going to tell it in a modern way. But take a look here. Luke 15. So we have a parable of the lost sheep. You've all heard this story, I'm sure. So there's 99 sheep. One wanders away. What's God like? God seeks out that lost sheep that's wandered off. That's what God is like. God looks for lost things. I kind of like that. God's in the business of finding lost things. Parable of a lost coin. This is kind of humorous. Jesus had a sense of humor. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Does she not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? When she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, rejoice with me, I found my lost coin. And you can see this woman just frantically sweeping through the house, trying to find this lost coin, and she finds it. Ah, I got it. Let's celebrate. And then the parable that we're very familiar with is the parable of the lost son. But I think we get anesthetized to it.
So what I want to do, sometimes I'm just going to read you stories, because I think stories can help us a lot in moving to a new place. So let's take a look at the parable of the prodigal son. And again, the purpose behind the parable is to help human beings understand what God is like so that they can deal with their stuff and not hide it. See, it's like human beings seem to be like this. We have an iron box. And in that iron box, we put all of the stuff nobody is ever going to know about. Could be sins, life experiences, hurt, pain. It's too much. We put it in the iron box. We lock it. Nobody's getting in there. And so Jesus strings together these stories in Luke 15 to help us unlock it and let that stuff be exposed to light. So that we become free. Free. So, the parable of the prodigal somebody. A young girl grows up on a cherry orchard just above Traverse City, Michigan. Her parents, a bit old-fashioned, tend to overreact to her nose ring, the music she listens to, and the length of her skirts. They ground her a few times, and she sees inside. "I hate you," she screams at her father when he knocks on the door of her room after an argument. And that night, she acts on a plan she has mentally rehearsed scores of times. She runs away. She's visited Detroit only once before, on a bus trip with her church youth group to watch the Tigers play. Because newspapers in Traverse City report in lurid details the gangs, the drugs, and the violence in downtown Detroit, she concludes this is probably the last place her parents will look for her. California, maybe, or Florida, but not Detroit. Her second day there, she meets a man who drives the biggest car she's ever seen. He offers her a ride, buys her lunch, and arranges a place for her to stay. He gives her some pills that make her feel better than she's ever felt before. She was right all along, she decides. Her parents were keeping her from all the fun. The good life continues for a month, 2 months, a year. The man with the big car, she calls him boss, teaches her a few things that men like. Since she's underage, men pay a premium for her. She lives in a penthouse, orders room service whenever she wants. Occasionally, she thinks about the folks back home, but their lives now seem so boring and provincial that she can hardly believe she ever grew up there. She has a brief scare when she sees her picture printed on the back of a milk carton with a headline, "Have you seen this child?" But by now she has blonde hair, and with all the makeup and body-piercing jewelry she wears, nobody would mistake her for a child. Besides, most of her friends are runaways and nobody squeals in Detroit. After a year, the first sallow signs of illness appear, and it amazes her how fast the boss turns mean. "These days we can't mess around," he growls. And before she knows it, she's out on the street without a penny to her name. She still turns a couple of tricks a night, but they don't pay much, and all the money goes to support her habit. When winter blows in, she finds herself sleeping on metal grates outside the big department stores. Sleeping is the wrong word. A teenaged girl at night in downtown Detroit can never relax her guard. Dark bands circle her eyes. Her cough worsens. One night, as she lies awake listening for footsteps, all of a sudden, everything about her life looks different. She no longer feels like a woman of the world. She feels like a little girl lost in a cold and frightening city. She begins to whimper. Her pockets are empty and she's hungry. She needs a fix. She pulls her legs tight underneath her and shivers under the newspaper she's piled atop her coat. Something jolts a synapse of memory, and a single image fills her mind of May in Traverse City, with a million cherry trees blooming at once, with her golden retriever dancing through the rows and rows of blossomy trees in chase of a tennis ball.
God, why did I leave? She says to herself, and pain stabs at her heart, my dog back home eats better than I do now. She's sobbing, and she knows in a flash that more than anything else in the world, she wants to go home. Three straight phone calls, three straight connections with the answering machine. She hangs up without leaving a message the first two times, but the third time she says, Dad, Mom, it's me. I was wondering about maybe coming home. I'm catching a bus up your way, and I'll get there about midnight tomorrow. If you're not there, well, I guess I'll just stay on the bus till it gets to Canada. Takes about 7 hours for a bus to make all the stops between Detroit and Traverse City, and during that time, she realizes the flaws in her plan. What if her parents are out of town and miss the message? Shouldn't she have waited another day or two until she could talk to them? And even if they're home, they probably wrote her off as dead long ago. She should have given them some time to overcome the shock. Her thoughts bounce back and forth between these worries and the speech she's preparing for her father. Dad, I'm sorry. I know I was wrong. It's not your fault. It's all mine. Can you forgive me? She says the words over and over, her throat tightening even as she rehearses them. She hasn't apologized to anybody in years. The bus has been driving with lights on since Bay City. Tiny snowflakes hit the pavement, rubbed worn by thousands of tires, and the asphalt steams. She's forgotten how dark it gets at night out here. A deer darts across the road, and the bus swerves. Every so often, a billboard, a sign posting the mileage to Traverse City. Oh, God. When the bus finally rolls into the station, its air brakes hissing in protest, the driver announces in a crackly voice over the microphone, 15 minutes, folks, that's all we have here. 15 minutes to decide her life. She checks herself in a compact mirror, smooths her hair, and licks the lipstick off her teeth. She looks at the tobacco stains on her fingertips and wonders if her parents will notice. If they're there. She walks into the terminal not knowing what to expect. Not one of the thousand scenes that have played out in her mind prepare her for what she sees. There in the concrete walls and plastic chairs, bus terminal in Traverse City, Michigan, stands a group of 40 brothers and sisters and great aunts and uncles and cousins and a grandmother and a great grandmother to boot. They're all wearing goofy party hats and blowing noisemakers. And taped across the entire wall of the terminal is a computer-generated banner that reads, Welcome Home. Out of the crowd of well-wishers breaks her dad. She stares out through the tears quivering in her eyes like hot mercury and begins the memorized speech. Dad, I'm sorry, I know. He interrupts her. Hush, child. We have no time for that. No time for apologies. You'll be late for the party. That's what God is like. That's what God is like. I can see Jesus Christ wearing a goofy party hat. The big grin on his face, and the angels walking, watching with some amazement when they see a human being finally saying, Lord, I'm going to trust you, and I'm coming home. That's Luke 15. That's Luke 15. And he told that story because he knew how hard spiritual formation is. Because it involves opening that box and looking at what has to change. And it involves trusting.
trusting that even when he seems wild and crazy or unresponsive, or even it seems mean-spirited sometimes, he's really not. He's just welcoming somebody home and taking a human character that's very flawed and skewed and out of joint and clicking it back in place, setting broken bones. And occasionally when a broken bone is set, how do we respond? Ow! Well, right. But the bone must be set. Or we'll what? Walk with a limp for the rest of our lives. So the call to discipleship is the call to change. Take a look. There's a couple of texts I want to share a little bit from my life because I had a big iron box filled with all kinds of stuff, so much of which I will not share with you. But there are two texts that really spoke to me as I was kind of working through the issues and continue to do so, that I think that all of us will be working through in some way in this course. Do you remember how I mentioned a Latin phrase last time, meditatio scripturarum? Meditatio scripturarum. If you read the first few pages of devotional classics, they'll also mention a phrase here. In fact, if you have the book, what did I do with my... If you have the book, I think, let's take a look here. If you look at the introduction, they mention a section, reading with the heart. Now think that through with me. Reading with the heart. Not reading so much with the mind, but reading with the heart. The Desert Fathers, Egyptian monks living out in the desert in the 3rd and 4th century, spoke of studying with the mind in the heart. No disjunction. Studying with the mind in the heart. And there's a phrase I'd like you to know. It's this Latin phrase that you'll find a few lines down where reading with the heart is mentioned. Lectio Divina. Lectio Divina. Divine reading. Divine reading. And divine reading is taking a biblical text and putting yourself in the text as an observer. Or you put yourself in the text as one of the characters in the text. Are you with me? So if Peter's in the text, you might become Peter. If Mary's in the text, you might become the mother of God, depending on what happens and how the Spirit of God is working in you. Well, I was working through some of the issues involved in that story myself. And I was reading this text. So let's turn over to Matthew, verse 13 of Matthew 19. Then little children were brought to Jesus for him to place his hands on them and pray for them. But the disciples rebuked those who brought them. Jesus said, "Let the little children come to me and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these." When he had placed his hands on them, he went on from there. All right, Lectio Divina. So we look at a text like this and we say a prayer. And the prayer would be something like, "Lord, I desire to enter into this text, not simply with my mind, but with my heart. I want to move into the text. Bring the text to life for me. Let there be a movement of your spirit so it begins to speak to me." And one thing you can do then, in your mind's eye, is place yourself in the text. So I was praying about this text. This must have been 25 years ago. I was praying about what was going on in this text. And here's what I saw. I saw Jesus. He was actually sitting under a tree on a stool of some kind. And the disciples were gathered around him, kind of in the background. And they were watching women bringing their children to Jesus to be blessed. And they didn't have happy expressions on their faces. They were thinking, "Oh, this is much... this rabbi has much more important things to do than be spending time with these children and the women taking up his time. Rabbi, surely you have better things to do." And Jesus is just irritated as anything with him. So he chews them out, basically says, "Will you just be quiet, stop, be quiet, watch, listen." And then he goes back, and when he's looking at the kids, he just has this look of utter delight on his face. He just can't get enough of them. And there's a line of women taking their kids up to Christ. And the kids are doing the things that kids do in lines. And this is what I saw, literally. I saw these kids just kind of You know, they're just, and they're bouncing around, whatever, just being kids. And the mothers are saying, shh, shh, calm down, the rabbi's coming. And then I saw something that was really embarrassing. Here, standing in line, is someone who looks like he's about 6'4", about 200 pounds, a man, and he's standing in line. And I thought, oh no. But it was very interesting what was going on inside of me. I didn't want to be there because it was embarrassing, but I really wanted to be there. So my posture was not, my posture was, don't anybody look at me. Don't talk to me. Let me be. I just want to be here. But I wanted to be in line. I wanted to be in line. You know what? Why I think I wanted to be there? I think I wanted to know what he thought of me with all that stuff. I wanted to know. There was a story there. There was already a lived life. What did he think about all that? What would he say to me? And so the line got shorter and shorter and shorter. And finally, there's just a mother with her child in front of me. And he's looking at this child, and this child's bouncing around in his lap and so on. And finally, and he's looking down. Child walks off. And the tension within me was very high because I was wondering. Don't you wonder sometimes about something like that? I'm wondering. And he turned and looked at me. And his expression was one of delight. But before I knew it, he reached up and he grabbed me by the front of my shirt. And he pulled me to himself. This big old guy, boom. So it's kind of humiliating. And then he whispered, I just want to tell you something. I'm really proud of you. And I said, no, you're not. Oh, I am. I said, why would you be proud of somebody like me? And his response was, generally speaking, because you're opening up that box. And then he smiled. And off I went. And it was a good thing. And that experience in Meditatio Scripturarum, Lectio Divina, enabled me to take steps I would not normally have taken in a new direction, steps that were going to be at times excruciatingly painful, because I knew what he was like. And I knew if I said, Lord, you know what I've been doing? I mean, we can really be stupid sometimes, can we not? It's as though he doesn't know what we're doing. It's just like God is like this. You did what? Oh, I never imagined you would ever do such a thing. Oh, you're sinful. Sinful. I never imagined. And yet we can think like that. So what do? We try to put a Band-Aid on a shrapnel wound. Our guts are spilling out. We're ready to die. And we think to ourselves, well, let me make myself really nice looking. And then come to God. And the Lord is saying, oh, will you just stop? Will you just stop? This is going to take radical surgery. You're going to have to trust me. See how irrational we can be? To think that God doesn't know what we're thinking or doing? And yet sometimes we'll think like that. It's enough to give somebody a headache. Call to discipleship is the call to change. I had issues with fear. For example, for years I had a phobic response to flying. That's really bad when you got to fly a lot. And you have a phobic response to flying. And I had this experience just before I was to, the next day, fly to South Africa. It was about 10 years ago. I had to fly to South Africa. I was afraid. The thought of being on an airplane for 19 hours, it was like being in hell for 19 hours. I'm claustrophobic, I don't like heights. This is a perfect recipe for me to let out a scream. And I'm praying, and I'm trying to think to myself, is there any other way to get to South Africa from Philadelphia? Is there a train? How long would a boat take? Anything but this, oh God. help me, help me. And I was turned to this text that was Mark. This is in Mark chapter 4. Have you ever been really afraid like that? Phobic response to something? Phobic responses are irrational. It's not like you can wrap your mind around them and say, Chris, you're much safer on an airliner than you are crossing the street. And your mind says, of course. And everything else says, no, no, no. No, 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 you don't know. I know. If I get on that plane, I have a prophetic call to let everybody else know it's going down. So I would be a joy to sit next to on a plane. I think you want to get off now. We're going down. So I'm dealing with these kinds of issues. A real nut. Verse 35 of Mark 4. That day, when evening came, he said to his disciples, let's go over to the other side. Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. Verse 37, a furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it nearly swamped. The airliner has hit severe turbulence. It is bouncing around the sky. We've just lost an engine. We're going down. Mayday, mayday, this is United 452. We have a problem. These are all things going through my mind. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, Teacher, don't you care if we drown? He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, Quiet, be still. Then the wind died down, and it was completely calm. He said to his disciples, there it is in the text, you see it? Why are you so afraid? No, I'm using Lectio Divina with this text, and for some reason, who knows why, I was reading the text in German. I still remember it. I'm reading the text in German. I'm in the boat with Jesus. I placed myself in that boat, and he turned to me and said in German, Wie seid ihr so ängstlich? Wie seid ihr so ängstlich? Which being translated means, why are you so afraid? Why are you so afraid? Here's I must have been 40 at the time, 43 maybe. Why are you so afraid? Lord, you don't understand airliners. Allow me to explain. No. Why are you so afraid? What do you think is going to happen? You think I'm not going to be with you there? You think I can't make it to 35,000 feet? You think I don't know how that plane's put together? You think, what are you thinking? I don't know. All I know is I'm afraid. All right, we'll work on it. But wie seid ihr so ängstlich? Why are you so afraid? So for some in this auditorium today, they are afraid. They're afraid that they're not going to make it out of this place in 4 years. They're afraid that they maybe made a bad choice. They're afraid because things at home are not good. They're afraid because they're going to be asked to speak in a public speaking class, and every time they stand up in front of folks, they want to vomit. They're afraid because they never met that person they really want to meet, and they're afraid they're going to be lonely all their life. They're afraid they met somebody and got involved with somebody, and now they don't like him. What are they going to do? I mean, fear, 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 fear. Wie seid ihr so ängstlich? Why are you so afraid? That might be worth journeying about. And for some of us, it's not issues that have to do with fear. If it is, journal about it. And ask yourself the question, why are you so afraid? And then you might list specifically. Specificity is good at this point. It helps. List what you're afraid of. List it. I'm afraid I'm going to die. And then you say to yourself, Chris, you shouldn't be afraid to die. I must not believe anything. I don't really believe. I'm going to hell. You know, one thing leads to the next thing to the next thing. I'm afraid to die. Just tell Christ, Lord, even though you were raised from the dead, I'm afraid to die. I'm afraid I'm going to get sick. I'm afraid I'll never find somebody. I'm afraid I will never find my vocation. I'm afraid I'm too stupid. I'm afraid I'm this. I'm afraid I'm that. Just list them. And we just offer it to Christ. And he'll know what to do with all that stuff. For some of us, we're thinking, you know, I'm not afraid of anything. Fine. What is the problem? I've never met a human being who did not have stuff. So don't have a fear entry. Have a stuff entry. This is my stuff, Lord. Here it is. And see, he'll ask us to change. But we can trust him at that point because he knows our condition. He knows of what we are made. He knows we are dust. And he loves his little dust balls. But he knows we're dust. He knows we're apt to just wander off like what? Think Luke 15. Wander off like sheep. Just wander off. Don't even know what we're doing, just wandering off. Lord, I lost my mind this past weekend. You won't believe what I did. Oh, yeah, I believe it. You lost your mind. Now, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to move in a new direction? The call to discipleship is the call to change. And Jesus is insistent at this point. He's wild. He is not domesticated, is he? He's kind of a wild man. Because he loves us so much. Do you remember how C.S. Lewis describes Aslan? Do you remember that first novel of the Narnia Tales? The children have met Mr. Beaver, and they're finding out about this lion, Aslan. And a lion, that sounds wild. So one of the kids asks Mr. Beaver, is he a tame lion? And Mr. Beaver is quite brought back by this idea. And he said, tame? No, he's not tame. He's wild. But he's good. And what Lewis brings together are two things that we tend to separate. Jesus is not tame when it comes to love. He can be wild. He'll pursue people all their lives, reaching out. So I want you to think that one through. What's God like? And be honest. And if in your heart you think God is a sadist, don't lie. Best to get it out. And then ask yourself the question, why do I feel that way? Now, let's just take a look at a couple of things from these readings. I want you to turn to the reading by C.S. Lewis in Devotional Classics. If you don't have the book today, note these sections. Section 4 and Section 5. These are both asterisks, all right? When Lewis speaks of the most dangerous thing, I want you to remember what the most dangerous thing is. So go back to the text, read it, study it. So the most dangerous thing. Teachers will tell you, this is Lewis speaking now, teachers will tell you that the laziest boy in the class is the one who works the hardest in the end. They mean this. If you give two boys, say, a proposition in geometry to do, the one who is prepared to take trouble will try to understand it. The lazy boy will learn it by heart because for the moment that needs less effort. But 6 months later, when they're preparing for the exam, that lazy boy is doing hours and hours of miserable drudgery over things the other boy understands and positively enjoys in a few minutes. Now, here's the sentence. Laziness means more work in the long run. We can even be emotionally lazy, psychiatrically lazy. It's too hard to deal with, Lord. I'm not dealing with it. I just figure it'll just go away sooner or later. Or I'd just rather walk with this limp, dragging my left leg than deal with it, because to deal with it's just too hard. Lewis says, laziness means more work in the long run. Or look at it this way. In a battle or in mountain climbing, there is often one thing which it takes a lot of pluck to do. But it is also, in the long run, the safest thing to do. This is an interesting English expression. If you funk it, you will find yourself hours later in far worse danger. The cowardly thing is also the most dangerous thing. See how that ties in with that exercise on fear? So courage is called for in spiritual formation. Courage. Now, take a look at this book by Ortberg. All right? I think that this title of this chapter is worth thinking about, to morph. It's Ortberg's way to talk about change, morphing, as he puts it. And then he uses a few illustrations here that I want you just to chew on. First illustration he uses is Popeye. When I was a kid in the 50s, Popeye was on TV all the time. I don't know if he's still on TV or not. If you take a look here at page 13, he talks about, Ortberg, that is, talks about universal disappointment. Universal disappointment. And writes this. One of the most profound statements I have heard about the human condition was one I first encountered when I was only 5 years old. It was spoken by my hero, Popeye the Sailor Man. When he was frustrated or wasn't sure what to do or felt inadequate, Popeye would simply say, "I am what I am." Popeye was not a sophisticated guy. He'd never been in therapy and was woefully out of touch with his shadow self and his inner child. He didn't have much of an education as far as we know. No, he knew who he was, a simple, seafaring, pipe-smoking, olive-oil-loving sailor man, and he wouldn't pretend to be anything else. I do like that aspect of him. He doesn't pretend to be anything else. He owned his story, as Lewis Smedes puts it. Lewis Smedes is a well-known Christian ethicist. I am what I am. But I always thought there was a note of sadness in Popeye's expression. It was generally offered as an explanation of his shortcomings. Here's a possible journal exercise. How do you explain your shortcomings to yourself? Again, I'll toss out 1,000 of them to you, ideas to journal about. And if one resonates with you and you think that's the one for you, that's the one to work on, if it doesn't resonate, don't worry about it. Back to Popeye. I always thought there was a note of sadness in Popeye's expression. It was generally offered as an explanation of his shortcomings. It does not anticipate much growth or change. It doesn't leave him much of a shot at getting to be what he am not. Don't get your hopes up, he seemed to say. Don't expect too much. I am what I am. And he would add, in his bleakest moments, that's all that I am. So what could you be? Becomes the question. I want to toss that out at you. What could you be rather than what you are right now? And he goes on and he says, that is the sad cry of the human race. You have said those words in your own way, and so have I. This is the struggle between disappointment and hope. Now, I will leave this part of it to yourself, but I want to point it out. Take a look very carefully at pages 19 through 21. And there he talks about actually three different Greek verbs, morphao, sumorphidzo, and so on, all having to do with this idea of morphing or changing. And he mentions actually a butterfly, metamorphosis, cocoon, change takes place, a butterfly emerges. St. John Chrysostom was Archbishop of Constantinople in the late 4th century. And at the end of his life, he was exiled by the Roman Empress Eudoxia because he kept scolding her in church. It wasn't a good idea. He is one of the great preachers in the history of the church. Chrysostom is Chrysostomos in Greek. It means golden mouth. It was his nickname. John the Golden Mouth. And he was exiled up to a place in Armenia, in the Caucasus area up there, a little town called Caucasus. He died in exile. And people in Constantinople were asking the question of John, what is God doing? And so he wrote a work at the end of his life. And the first line of the work is this: to all those who were scandalized by recent events in Constantinople. And he chews on this question of how God works and how strange it is. And one of the things that he does is he draws a contrast between Herod Antipas. Do you remember Herod Antipas, the man who had John the Baptist executed? And John the Baptist. And John's a great preacher, and John, throughout that work, keeps coming back to these two. And he says this: by all appearances, Herod was victorious, and John dies. Herod lives, and John is beheaded. By all appearances. He keeps saying that. By all appearances. Now catch it. The overarching theme in this work on divine providence is, don't judge by appearances. Don't judge by appearances. So you might journal about that when we talk about this kind of spiritual growth and development. Where have I been judging by appearances and on the basis of appearances thought God is not working, God could not be working here, it's too much? Where have I done that? And in reality, God has been working. So I want you to read carefully the story of Mabel in this book. I won't read it to you in class today because I want to tell you a different story. The story of Mabel. Mabel was an African-American woman, blind, deaf, cancer-ridden, her face disintegrating, and one of the great saints in the church. And what Ortberg learned through Mabel's story is, don't judge by appearances as to whether God is working or not. I learned that lesson a little bit differently. I mentioned to you that I was while I was doing my doctoral work, I was involved in psychiatric care. And it was at one of the state psychiatric hospitals in New Jersey. Man, it was just like for 4 or 5 years, the Lord was just beating the heck out of me, trying to bring me to my senses, I suppose. And I tended to judge by appearances. And if you judge by appearances in a psychiatric hospital, you're going to get discouraged. And I was there for 3 years, I believe it was. It was the one hospital that Mother Teresa visited when she came to New Jersey, because she would always hang out with the poorest of the poor. And these were psychiatric, geriatric people, meaning they were all 55 years old and dying of something, and psychiatrically ill on top of it. And I reached a point at that place where I sinned. Do you remember I talked about the sin of presumption last class? So we can presume against God's grace and just, well, you know, I know he'll forgive me, so I'll sin anyway and presume against his grace. That idea? Well, there's a different way to presume against God, and that is to say, you're not working. I can't see you working when we judge by appearances. Now, it was an evening, and I was out of gas, physically and emotionally and spiritually. I think I had performed a funeral that day of a dying schizophrenic. I think I had an experience walking into a ward at the hospital. I wore a collar, walked onto the ward. There was I still remember her name. Her first name was Gracie. She was in a chair, slumped over. She saw me, and she started to bang her head on her desk in front of her. I rushed, and I grabbed her, and she said, Dr. Hall, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I don't want to die. Bang, bang, bang. And a week later, she died. And I buried her. And I began to think, you're not working. And then I crossed the line in the sand. You don't care. You don't care. I'm sick of this. You're not working here. These people are dying. Don't you care? But I was, you know, had this uniform on, so I couldn't talk like that out loud to anybody, because they'd be shocked. So it's at the end of the day, and I'm ready to go home. I'm just fed up with everything. And the clinical care director of the hospital called up and said, we have Rachel so-and-so in the hospital. She's dying in the ICU unit at Easton Hospital in Pennsylvania. Could you pay a call on her on the way home? Of course, you know, kind of lying through my teeth, I'd be glad to. And I hung up the phone, and I thought, this is the last thing I want to do. And I was so frustrated. Have you ever been like that? So frustrated and angry, and you want to see God working, and everything just looks wrong. And so I drove the hospital kind of grumbling the whole way. I went in and out. I don't want to see somebody die. I just want to go home. And by all appearances, everything looks wrong. Everything looks wrong. So I walk into this ICU unit, intensive care unit. All the nurses smile at me, and I smile at them. God speak beyond you, and so on and so forth. And then on into this room. And I walked into the room, and there is Rachel lying on a gurney. She has a respirator down her throat. You know what a respirator is? And it's pumping air into her lungs to keep her alive. And she's restrained because she keeps pulling her IVs out because she's terribly confused. I looked up at the screen, and I'm watching her vital signs, and she's beginning to bottom out. And I'm thinking, I don't want to see another person die. And I walked over to her. Her eyes were distended. Her back was arching up and down every time that piston pushed air into her lungs. She looked, by all appearances, to be terrified. And I said to her this, Rachel, would you like me to say a prayer for you? Professional pastoral care. Would you like me to say a prayer? And she shook her head, yes, yes, yes. And it was some kind of faithless prayer. Lord, dear Lord, you know, be with Rachel in this time of need. Watch over, protect, and keep her. Touch her with your Holy Spirit. And I'm out of here. And I said, amen. And I turned to go. As I was turning to go, with her left arm, she began to go like this. And I knew what that meant. She wanted to write me something. Psychiatric patients almost invariably know when you're lying. And I thought, I deserve it. I deserve to get chewed out. She could tell I didn't care. All right, fine. Now a note from a dying psychiatric patient chewing me out how I was just faking the whole thing. So I got a piece of paper. I've kept it. Here it is. Now, I know the light is so bright. I don't know if you can see her writing. This is Rachel's writing. And I kept it. And I had it on a clipboard, and I held it down to her, and I loosened to her restraint. And she must have worked on this for 10 minutes. And she's writing and writing. And I thought to myself, she's mad. She's mad. And she finished. Her expression never changed. It never changed. By all appearances, she was as terrified at the end of the story is at the beginning. And so I grabbed it, and I thought, well, let's take my medicine and head home. Here's the first line. I love my Jesus. When I read that, I thought, oh, my goodness. And I can remember feeling a tingle almost at my back, as though there was someone behind me watching me. Here's the next line. Thanks for a visit. And I thought, Rachel, you shouldn't be thanking me. And this is the line that got me, the third line. Your Jesus loves you too. the liturgy of a dying schizophrenic. Your Jesus loves you too. As though Jesus Christ took the mind and body of a dying schizophrenic and said, I'm going to teach him something. To not judge by appearances. Next line. I'm blessed. Last line. Thanks be to God. Isn't that something? It was so amazing to me. I thought, keep it. Share it. Share John Chrysostom's story. And let everybody know. As we enter into this process of change together, don't judge by appearances. God is at work in places where we would never imagine he's working. And that's where that word comes that we started out with today. Do you remember it? Trust. Not a trust built on whistling in the dark, but a trust built on the reality that Jesus Christ has come into our world and taken the medicine he asks us to drink ourselves at times. He's been raised from the dead. He's ascended to the right hand of the Father. He will come again. And then he says, and you're going to have to trust me because I want to take you and make you like me. Well, we'll start next class with questions. And then we'll just keep working on this stuff. Okay? Bring next class, bring devotional classics, your Bible, and Ortberg's book.